Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. How are you today? Thank you for joining another episode of Talk with Tenny. And I believe that Yvonne is on the line. Am I correct?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I just left a meeting and I was telling some people about the radio. In fact, I'm trying to email them the telephone number right now because I didn't have it with me. I'm trying to spread the word.
Well, thank you very much. The number, if you'd like to call in, is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. It's my understanding that the Energy and Commerce Committee had another meeting today, a hearing. Do you know anything about this, Yvonne?
No, unfortunately, I was in school all the day today. What happened?
It's my understanding I'm working on it. Hello. So I'm not sure what's going on here with my technical issues, but I'm fearing that this is going to be a problem all night. Yvonne, are you there?
Yes, I saw there was some issue, and I don't know if it's just getting too popular now.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long that went on before I realized it because I'm not in the studio tonight. I'm on the road, and so I've got apparently it's not as easy to do from the road as it is from home. Anyway, so I'm not sure how much you heard of what I was saying or.
You blipped out, and I continued to came in. The last thing I heard was that there was some action in the Congress on the Murphy bill today.
Yes, that Murphy is they held a hearing where it's my understanding that among three people who testified was DJ Jaffe, a forensic psychiatrist, and the father of somebody who had been assigned a psychiatric label. Unfortunately, I can't get into the document and have the computer running. My plan to
call right now to see if there's anything there on it as we speak. But DJ Jaffe there, I've read his post in the Huffington Post, where I can imagine what he had to say. And you said a psychiatrist?
Yeah, his name was Dr. Michael Wellner, a forensic psychiatrist. He's the founder and chairman of the forensic panel. I'm not sure what forensic panel. DJ Jaffe, the founder and executive director of Mental Illness Policy Organization, and Edward Kelly, the father of son with schizophrenia and advocate for reform. I'm just reading off of their press release here.
Is Michael Wellner W-I-L-N-E-R?
W-E-L-N-E-R. He's a forensic psychiatrist.
Chairman of the forensic panel.
That's what it says, yes.
He looks like a relatively young man.
I'm not exactly sure, but there's no... I have not been able to find the link to the actual hearing. I'm not sure if they're available anyway, where. But this is definitely of concern for us because the people that they have as panelists certainly would not be described as people who didn't have their own agenda to be pushing.
So DJ Jaffe.
We have another caller on the line, area code 541. Your own line is open.
Hello, this is Dan Burdick.
Hello, you're on air with Talk with Kenny. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Dan Burdick in Oregon.
Hi, if you could just speak up, we're having a little bit of technical issue tonight. So if you could just speak up as much as you can.
So is this me that you're speaking to?
I'm sorry?
Excuse me. Hello, this is Dan Burdick. Am I speaking Hi, this is Dan Burdick. I'm in the library, so I had to get outside here.
Hi, yes, you are live on the air. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, well, that DJ Jaffe and E. Fuller Torrey, they're quite the little propaganda units there. What were we just saying about their panel?
So apparently the Energy Commerce the Energy and Commerce Committee held a briefing regarding committee's report on federal programs addressing severe mental illness. And the three panelists were DJ Jaffe, Edward Kelly, who is a family member, and Michael Wellner, who is a forensic psychiatrist. And they were going to be discussing the year-long investigation reviewing mental health resources and programs across the federal spectrum. And apparently the committee's investigation began in January 2013 following the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, and against the backdrop of subsequent mass killings tied to untreated SMI at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. and Fort Hood, Texas. So they clearly have an agenda there. Had you heard anything about this, Daniel? Tim?
TJ, well, I saw Tim Murphy, the representative, supporting the H.R. 3717 and a couple YouTube videos of CNN, orchestrated CNN television appearances. And I'm sure they're selling the exact same. They're selling the same thing over and over and over again as DJ Jaffe and E. Fuller Torrey have been doing, and now they're making a big push to change the laws. It looks like they want to. In the wake of all the revelations about the manipulations and lies of psychiatry, they're acting like psychiatry is the science and the medicine, and that everyone needs to be screened. Everyone in the country needs to be screened for pre-crime, and given the modern medical treatments of psychiatry, to make sure we're all safe from these tragedies, such as Newtown or the Batman killer. So we want to screen everyone in the country and make sure that they're given treatment, medication, modern medication, which they make so much money off of, if people don't understand that they're ill because of their anosognosia, then they have to be forced to get this treatment, because that way people will be safe from crazy people. So,
I think this is a big problem. Yes.
And it's like Russia.
Since you don't have access to the internet right now, I've just been looking. You can't believe everything on the internet. I've been looking at this Michael Wellner, who you said was a panelist. And evidently, he has the forensic panel that he has. He has a business. In fact, he's right there in New York City. And he is one of those experts that they call in, quote, unquote, from all over the country, the forensic expert. But I did see that he was responsible for getting ABC from taking off some of the videos of various people that have committed some of the violence that they think that they're going to lock people up by preventing. It says Dr. Wellner founded and serves as editor-in-chief of the Forensic Echo, originating the format of Breaking Science practitioner-written forensic monthly that combined commentary with case and science updates. He has been invited to testify before three state legislators on mental retardation and on video game violence. In 2007, ABC News signed Dr. Wellner to be the first forensic psychiatrist to go behind the scenes to acclaim law and justice unit. He has petition, for example, for having instigated network television to remove the killer's videos and following the Virginia Tech massacre. He has been recognized across disciplines and regions as an invited distinguished lecturer for the American College of Legal Medicine and Yale University School of Law. And he continues to treat patients in a New York-based practice. But it seems as though that he has a consulting firm where he goes around the country and he testifies. I don't see anything, but he is considered to be, but so is E. Fulatori, and we know what he thinks. He's considered a expert. I wish I really did have access to hear what he had to say, and maybe someone else maybe be familiar with him or the other principals that are on the panel while I try to see if I can find anything about the hearing today. But I just know that with Jaffe, he has written extensively about assisted outpatient treatment, and we know that what his position is. I don't know what his do you know what his medical background is, Lauren, or anyone on the line?
Jeffy is a psychiatrist.
No, he's not. No, he's not. Jeffy, I don't even think Jeffy is a psychologist. I don't think he has any. To the best of my knowledge, Jeffy's only experience is that he's a family member. Mm-hmm. Tori is a psychiatrist, but Jeffy, to the best of my knowledge, is not a mental health professional.
They're clearly on the same team, Jaffe and Tori. They are both supporting outpatient commitment. And they use the same words. Same talking points.
You can almost tell where one starts speaking and the other one leaves off.
Absolutely. It's the same operation with the same propaganda. Jaffe is like a new version, a new Tory. They're getting kind of old, so now they have two of them.
Dan, are you still there?
Can't hear you.
Yeah. I'm trying to. I'm in the Energy and Commerce Committee here and there. I'm trying to see if it's available.
This the forensic expert will, it just adds to the power of what they're doing for their presentation. He'll be representing how the people that are involved in like Fort Hood and the Batman killer and so forth, how they are people that are in need of treatment of medications.
Yeah, so and they've Tori was pretty successful in getting to Ann Coulter, who I've heard now on at least two shows talking about how the schizophrenics need to be medicated. And so Ann Coulter is now the big rallying cry on the right for pushing Tory's agenda, and she actually named him today on the Sean Hannity radio show. And so it's very concerning that they all are beating the same drum, and the whole thing is a fraud, and people need to be aware of that.
Lauren, I'm going to put on your site, on the Twitter site, a link to the briefing. There is, they do have the opening statement, and video is there for people to watch. So I'm going to put it on your Twitter page and mine, and if you can give people your Twitter page, they can go up there and actually get the, after the show, we'll have it up there so they can see the testimony.
Oh, great. Thanks, Yvonne.
Okay with you if I have permission to put that on your Twitter page.
Yeah, sure. It's at Lauren Tenney at Lauren Tenney 10E.
Yeah, I'm there now. Okay.
Great. So Daniel, what do you think about all of this and needs to be done?
It could be a large push by the is seen now. With them trying to defund SAMHSA and get more funding for inpatient and outpatient treatment, and they're acting like psychiatry is a modern science, and that everything that psychiatry does is perfectly okay and represents modern medicine. Their big push that we can see happening in the last year might be a backlash because people like Robert Whittaker were starting to have some effect. With the Rebecca Riley case, that was given a lot of publicity, and people learned that Dr. Kifuji had diagnosed a 2.5-year-old as having bipolar, and instead of giving the 2.5-year-old vitamin supplements and zinc and essential fatty acids, or she quote unquote diagnosed her as bipolar, she of course gave her Seroquel, Zyprexa, and Depakote, and she was dead at 4 years old. And so that got a lot of attention. And then Dr. Biderman and Wozniak at Harvard and in the Cambridge Pediatric, who caused the diagnoses of pediatric bipolar to skyrocket along with the sale of the drugs, they got some attention. And with the investigation by Senator Grassley of NAMI and of these key opinion leaders at universities such as Wozniak and Biderman at Harvard Charles Grassley at Columbia, the amount of money that they're being paid under the table by the drug companies, it was revealed that Dr. Biderman had had promised a drug company positive to them test results of a test of Risperdal that hadn't been done yet. So there's this professor at Harvard, Dr. Joseph Biderman, telling a drug company that they'll get positive results from a test, from a scientific clinical test, which hadn't been done yet. And that was one of the things revealed by Senator Grassley in the last couple of years. And then Robert Whitaker came out with Mad in America and his book Anatomy of an Epidemic, and those have gotten a lot of attention, and this current attack by these propaganda forces and political forces may be a large scale response to the certain amount of success. One other thing is, people may have noticed that the Risperdal, it was shown, Robert Whitaker brought attention that Risperdal was not actually superior to Haldol in the original test, and then so that the atypicals weren't atypical, and people have lawsuits about them causing diabetes and young boys developing female type breasts. So with all this media, with this certain amount of information getting out about how wrong and manipulative and lying psychiatry is, now they're just coming out and saying, well, of course they are the experts, and of course we need to screen everyone so that these tragedies won't happen because people aren't being treated for their undiagnosed mental illnesses.
Right, and nobody is holding the media accountable for letting this message continually get put out without any truth behind it, and the larger grasp of society is just going to be paying for it, and I think that people that are being relied on as the experts for this, including like people like DJ Jaffe, is just more evidence of how there is absolutely no balance to what it is that they are offering, and that people who may have a different perspective aren't going to be welcome in testifying or giving information to the government, who then is going to be making decisions based on fraudulent information. If you'd like to call into the show, the area code is 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167. If you have something you'd like to talk about, give a call. So as far as any potential strategies that can come out of this, there's a statement that came out on May 15th from Murphy saying, our investigative work revealed that those most in need of treatment, patients with serious mental illnesses such as persistent schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression, are the least likely to get acute medical help. They desperately, and then it just gets cut off there.
Lauren,
serious mental illness.
I just had time to pull up the opening statement of Tim Murphy, and we have included it on the Twitter page. And I just wanted to point out, I know that you may not have access to this yourself, but this is what they enumerate, and it won't take too short for me to say what their three focuses of interest were. The committee's probe focused on three areas of critical public policy. Scope of society's problem is untreated SMI. Two, now privacy laws may interfere with patient care, public safety, including mental health situations. And three, how federal resources appropriated for research into and treatment and mental illness are being spent. And they have a few findings there. And is it families have been shut out of the treatment team? Anosognia occurs in about 40% of persons with serious mental illness like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So,
if you deny that you need to be forced to take brain drugging toxic chemicals, then your illness has impaired your mental function to the degree that you don't understand that you need treatment. You have anosognosia. You don't want to be drugged, so that shows you don't have insight.
Well, he's saying that that's about 40% of the people. That's not quite
sure,
that, but that's a lot of people.
They keep changing the numbers around, but it's like, and they want to force people to take their drugs that are lucrative.
Well,
and,
here's another one, and I think we've heard this before. Healthcare providers often misinterpret HIPAA privacy rule, leaving family members in the dark about essential and timely information about their loved one's condition.
And
well,
I think that's part of how they're planning on relaxing the standards is by relaxing the privacy and HIPAA standards so that parents or family members would be able to have a more active role in getting somebody involved in involuntary treatment. And so what Ann Coulter was saying today from her read on it was that it would be a psychiatrist, a judge or legal person, and a family member who would be involved in making the decision about somebody having to comply with involuntary intervention, psychiatric intervention. And so this is very concerning for many people, especially. No, we're not talking about children. We're talking about adults. We're talking about family members having a legal role in the involuntary outpatient commitment process or the involuntary commitment process, regardless of inpatient or outpatient, but that family members, that the HIPAA standards will be relaxed to let the parents of an adult person have a say in their psychiatric treatment.
That's the selling point, though. They get people up to say, like, my whole life I've had this relative and haven't been able to get them the help that they clearly needed. So that's a major selling point for this thing, because it seems to make sense. It sounds good when they get their show person up to make that statement. But
that's not the only
sinister aspect of this thing.
This is number two.
It is sinister.
It's still number two. They said, in some cases, we heard by the committee, the lack of understanding of the HIPAA privacy rule was so pervasive that families were actually told they could not even provide information to the doctor. Yeah, I think this is going to be devastating, because if individuals are family members who have abused them in the past, and those same family members are able to intervene like this, many people are not going to tell doctors about family members, number one, and number two, many people will not seek even the most any kind of counseling, even if it's for just grief or something like that. If you feel as though your privacy is going to be exposed like that, you know, that's for some people that may could benefit from some therapy or some other things are not going to do it. This is the third one. This is a kicker. There is a critical shortage of psychiatric beds, providers, and outpatient treatment options for persons in the midst of psychiatric crisis.
Right, because that's what they want to do. They want to have us all taken to the streets and put back in institutions. And they're using these horrible, heinous crimes and murders as a way to justify it. And even if, you know, at the beginning of his statement, he runs off 7 or 8 different people who have, committed these murders, but there were over 10,000 murders in the year 2010. It is a fraud to make society think that if you eliminate these mass murders, that murder will be ended, or that psychiatry, there's a lot of background noise on somebody's line, or that psychiatry has any way of resolving these things. Which it absolutely just does not.
If anyone wants to call in that is listening to this on the internet, you can call 267-521-0167. I repeat, 267-521-0167. And you might want to go get pen and pencil, because before the broadcast is over with, we will have some announcements about some ways in which you may be able to help fight the Murphy Bill and some upcoming events. Right, Laura?
Yes.
Okay. There is now this is something, this is another one of their signings. The person, this is what Murphy statement himself before. With mental illness, must be homicidal or suicidal.
Yvonne, are you on a cell phone? Are you on a speakerphone, rather?
Yeah. Take it off?
Yeah, I'm just having a lot of trouble hearing you.
Okay. All right. A person with mental illness must be homicidal or suicidal before we'll give them treatment. It's like denying a patient care until after the heart attack occurs. How do you interpret that? That's just like saying that
I'm not exactly sure. This technology is just terrible tonight. I'm not exactly sure how they can argue this away, this idea of anosognosia, or however, but this idea that people don't have insight into what it is that's occurring, when so many people, when you look at the writings of the people that they're holding up as the reasons for these laws needing to exist, these people knew exactly what the problems were. They knew exactly where their issues were, and they were denied and not given assistance when they sought it out. And so the fear-mongering that's occurring in going after anybody who is refusing psychiatric intervention or is so illegitimate, and it's going to lead to massive human rights violations being committed across the country.
They keep trying to draw this line between violence and mental illness. Even in his opening statement today, which I'm just reading because I haven't seen the video yet, but it just seems to be a pattern, and I keep saying that we need to decouple mental health from violence prevention, because the two do not go together. I mean, everyone says even Murphy has said, I think, on some occasion, that people with mental illness are more prone to be a victim of violence themselves.
The first two paragraphs of his opening statement to the committee talked about how people with psychiatric histories are not more violent than other people. This is where the fraud is coming from. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth. At one point, they're saying that this is not the problem, and then they say, but the solution is going to be to force all people into a psychiatric history. And this utilitarian view of, the rights of all over the betterment of all over the rights of a few is, I think, at the heart of a lot of the problem of the way that they're pushing it.
Now, here's where they attack us. I'm going to skip from 4 to 6. Legal advocates and anti-psychiatry activists have used federal resources to block care for hardest-to-reach patients. Now, that is an out-and-out falsehood.
Can you read that again? Because you're breaking up every other word on my end.
I'm sorry. I don't have you on speaker at all. Legal advocates and anti-psychiatry activists have used federal resources to block care for the hardest-to-reach patients.
Yeah.
And I don't know any truly anti-psychiatry advocates that's gotten any federal money.
Yeah, I don't know any anti-psychiatry activists that get federal money either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the national alternative groups and SAMHSA itself are anti-psychiatry is ludicrous. There is not a shred of if you so much as suggest that maybe somebody should have access to advocacy, you are at threat of losing your funding on a national level. So this is such a scam that Murphy is putting forward by putting this kind of information out.
I guess this is why they want to take away the funding for the PAMI, for the Protection and Advocates. And for people that don't know, just like when we had, let's put it this way, in the worst times when we had large asylums and there were lots of abuse, and there still is abuse in some state hospitals, the federal government put in place protection and advocacy for each state, and this was funded separately, not from the state, because you wouldn't have a fox looking into the allegations of his son raiding the hen house. So these operations are in each state. They don't get a lot of money, a whole lot of money, but they are the legal advocates. They are the people that people can call when they are in institutions. And so some people that are in restricted settings in the community, and they're saying, this is what Murphy's committee is saying, that he's directly attacking the peer support recovery movement and the legal advocates that protect people. And, you know, these advocates sometimes are the last resource. When people are being abused, we still have reports of in institutions, even within the last year or 2 years, of people in hospitals being physically abused, sexually abused, forced to not get the kinds of medical attention that they would get. And we're not saying that there aren't good people working in these institutions. Last night we even had a nurse that called and talked about the kind of fraud that people commit in order to do these heinous things to people. But the only reason why they've even subsided is because of the PNAs in the different states. So,
And it's one of those things that, you know, people are maybe concerned about people that they love, or, you know, see somebody who's going through a rough time, and they hear these messages that psychiatry has, and they say okay because people are trained that doctors are good, decent people who know what that they're talking about. And what they wind up finding very often is not what, you know, what they get isn't what they necessarily signed up for. And I think that's one of the most major problems that we're going to be facing, is that people think that, that institutions and the drugs are all helpful, and they're really going to further destroy our society. If you'd like to call in, the area code is 267-521-0167, or you can live link in on blogtalkradio.com/talkwithtenny, 267-521-0167. I also was just, I just lost the page, but I was also, you know, a couple of days ago, we talked about several of the murders that had occurred in different prisons, including and jails, including Bradley Bollard, who was a 39-year-old man who died in solitary confinement, and he was his body after 7 days of being in solitary confinement. Darren Rainey, who was made to go into a scalding hot shower, where his skin was so burnt it shriveled off of his body, and then I was just informed of another murder of Kendra Shaw, who was a 25-year-old who was incarcerated for trying to steal a TV, and she was refused her asthma medication and died as a result of that. And so I think that we need to remind people of how this can go badly. And I think that Michael Blair's murder in Texas, well, they haven't ruled it a murder. They ruled it at this point a justified shooting. But Michael Blair, who whose family was concerned about him, called the hospital. The hospital refused to help them. Told the family to call 911. Mr. Blair's family was suspicious of the police to begin with, and so they had set up a cell phone camera before calling 911, which happened to capture the incident that occurred in under 6 minutes from when the police came banging on the bathroom door that Michael Blair had been behind, and tasered him and then killed him with 11 shots fired under three feet away, and shots
and you can see on the
fire.
And you can see even on the after, film you can see on the film that after the first shot he was actually on the floor. And one thing about the show, Lauren's show, is I suggest that when people come on the show, some of these things some people are well aware of, but I would come with pencil and paper in hand because, for example, if you just Google Michael Blair, you can go online and see the footage where this is going. I have to warn you that it's, you know, quite graphic, but you can imagine, you know, I keep saying this unholy alliance between the police and behavioral health, because in this country, I think almost, I don't know any place where this doesn't occur, but if you call someplace and they will tell you, there's an answering machine that answers, someone's not answering, they'll say, if this is an emergency, call 911. And people are thinking that, I guess if they call 911, they might get a, I don't know what they're thinking. They're thinking they're going to get an ambulance or some help or whatever else. But in too many of these cases, what happened is the police come and it ends up in the death of the person, and inevitably the family members say, what do they say, Lauren? If we had thought this was going to happen, we wouldn't have called. So,
I think that people need to realize that, and it's not just when you reach out in an emergency situation and those kinds of things or where you think there's a crisis, but if you call any psychiatric place anywhere in this country and it's after hours, there's going to be an answering machine that picks up that directs you to call 911. And you are going to call 911 and the police will show up. And, you know, if there is something legitimately criminal going on, of course the police, those are the people in the right role to call. But the overwhelming majority of situations of people in crisis, there is absolutely nothing criminal that has occurred. And police aren't prepared to deliver emotional support during a crisis that somebody may be having. Or the thing that more concerns me is when these family members think that there's some kind of crisis, that somebody isn't performing the way the family members want them to perform, therefore they must be, quote-unquote, mentally ill. And so that would justify it. And I don't think that we can forget that. I think for as many people as really have emotional, extreme emotional states and crises, there are as many people who are being targeted as having a psychiatric history simply because they don't share the same political, religious, cultural views of the people that they are close to. Underlying all of this is the economic issues. And so for family members who may be financially supporting their adult children and their adult children aren't complying with their wishes, this is a constant source of heatedness that often prompts the police being called. Or if a family member, for example, is the payer, if a person is on disability and the check goes to the family member, and then the family member gives the person money and issues over financial dispute between family members, I don't think that this can be underestimated at all as to some of the reasons
that... What people have to realize about the police is police are trained to give orders, and they expect people to obey. So if you have a person that you believe is compromised emotionally, or even if you believe they're compromised judgmentally, if you call the police, and as you said, Lauren, most of them are not trained to deal with this. You know, maybe a fire department might be a better person to call, and they tell the person to come here or lay down, and they don't move quick enough. And especially if they might be a person of color too, and they may. It's highly likely that the police, if they shoot them, it will be a justifiable shooting or killing. Because I think in some states it's different, but I know where I live and in other places, if a police gives you an order and you do not obey, that's almost as if you are attacking the police officer. This is how they're trained in the academy. So when there is a hearing to investigate the maiming or death, people get upset because people get off. I've had this argument with other people. I don't agree that it's justifiable, but even when it is a person who doesn't have a mental health condition in my community, I live in a mostly African-American community, even if it's not a person with a mental health issue, it shouldn't happen to anybody. But especially when someone, their judgment might be impaired. But anyone, if you think, well, I'm not doing anything, I'm in my own house, your neighbor's complaining about you or something, the fact is if the police use deadly force, in most cases, there's no repercussions to them. I don't know of any case where a person who was in emotional distress and they were killed where the police got any time. Do you, Lauren?
No.
Mm-hmm. So it's like people have had to understand that when they call 911, when the service provider in the county say we have 24-hour service. The question is asked, what do you mean by 24-hour service? Do you mean there's an answering machine, or do you mean that we can reach a team member or someone else? Even when you have, we have mobile crisis units here, but they rely on the police also. So if the Murphy bill is passed, there is more money for assisted outpatient treatment. Plus, this will raise this to a federal level. So even in small counties, they might be able to use U.S. Marshals services to take people away. So it's really making it sort of like criminals, involving the judicial system and something that, was something between a person and their doctor. And I understand that there, might be cases where a person might be so dangerous they might be have to inpatient committed. But there are already sufficient laws in most states. I don't know any state that does not have an inpatient commitment for people that might be dangerous. But for someone to say that the person is, it's okay for you to live in the community, but we think you're so dangerous that we will make decisions to have you take interventions that might cause you to have a heart attack, that might cause you to have arthritis, kidney and liver failure, is a bit much. And if you don't think that it will happen to you, you can revisit history in other countries because you only need, I think Lauren was saying, you need a psychiatrist, a family member, and law enforcement. Is that right, Lauren?
That's my understanding.
Psychiatrist and the judge. Yes, either one, or the family member and the judge and psychiatrist. So, by saying that you don't have to be a danger to yourself or others, and that many people have anosognosia, what they're doing is they're making it so that they can inpatient or outpatient commit anyone that they want. And say that they need to get medicated, even if they don't want to be medicated or don't understand that they need to be medicated because their anosognosia, their lack of insight due to their impairment, means that they can't understand that they should take the medication reliably. So they want to be able to force anyone that they select to be either to be taken away or to be forced to be drugged in the community indefinitely and without them being a danger to themselves or others, or perhaps being a pre-crime, a possible danger to others. So they want to take away any control on psychiatry, like you were saying about, what was that, PAMI? And any opposition to psychiatry, they want to overwhelm that, such as Alternatives Conference or all the input from Robert Whitaker and everyone else. They want to give much more power to psychiatry. And this is possibly a police state move, because with these connotations of pre-crime and their being able to select anyone for drugging that is not a danger to themselves or others even, and to make sure that they get drugged or taken away to inpatient indefinitely, anyone they select. So this is a totalitarian move.
Absolutely, and this is the danger in it. Area code 970, your line is open.
Hi, this is Amy in Colorado. Can you hear me?
Hey, Amy, how
yep.
you doing?
Hi, Amy.
I have a new Bluetooth set up on my phone, though, so I just want to make sure I'm coming through okay.
I'm great.
Okay.
Because I can shut it off and just talk on the phone, if that's better.
No, you sound good now.
Okay, good. I wanted to talk a little bit about the 911 and calling the police. Because it's not just crisis lines or mental health centers. It's also drop-in centers. Any peer staff person that has a voicemail message always says at the end, and if this is an emergency, dial 911. Something that I'm railing about here, because that's exactly what happens, is that the police come. And we've had some dreadful in Colorado with the governor's capital, and he was actually opening up his coat to show the police that he had no weapons, and they shot him, killed him. And so I had some curriculum about, I had an education program, how not to be killed by the police, you know, which was really valuable. That got squashed by the company that I worked for. But it is so important for people to understand that. People don't know the realities of the mental health system, what it looks like from the inside and through experience. And they have a very benign point of view about their expectations. It's dangerous to call the police. And I forget who was talking, maybe Yvonne, about if you disobey, you didn't hear, you didn't understand, you're confused, and it's justifiable. Just not obeying makes it justifiable. So it's very dangerous. And when people call because they think things happen, when they do things like NAMI suggested of tipping over the furniture to make it look worse than it is so the police drag your loved one off. Clayton Stranger was suggesting that, you know, the best thing to do is to really rile somebody up so they react, you know. It's just insidious and very, very, very dangerous, and it is not something to be taken lightly at all. It's very important to me that people really
understand. Amy, many people don't understand this because that you can call, that some cases, you check with your jurisdiction, but you can call the fire department. And in many cases, the fire department is a more appropriate person to call.
Compassionate and kind. I used to run a drop-in center in a real urban area, a very low-income area. And anytime anybody had a crisis, which when I started there was every day, because that was what the community was used to, and I always said, do you have a headache? Does your stomach hurt? Are you having trouble breathing? Because everybody always had all three, you know, and that gave you legal reason to call the fire department because they have a physical problem. Who, the fire department would come and kneel beside the person and say, are you all right? And the police would come in with their hands on their hips and rolling their eyes, and, you know, it was night and day. So, yes, exactly. That's a wonderful tip, Yvonne. Thank you.
I had a little conversation on Facebook, and you might have seen the thread with four firemen. One of them was from New York. Not firemen, the emergency medical personnel. And my question was, had any of them ever been called? You're breaking up some. Have any of you been called for a psychiatric emergency? And the funny thing about it is first they start talking about coming for psychiatric emergencies for the police as if they're having one. But they were saying, yeah, we go out for psychiatric, not psychiatric emergencies, but they go and they find that that's what the case is. I think that if you have to call someone and I understand some resources are thin, it is better to call the emergency services team, because you're talking about supposedly a medical issue, and they're not going to come with a gun on the hip.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't.
And they have arresting authority. A lot of people don't understand. In most jurisdictions, firemen and policemen have the same authority.
And to my mind, it's like the difference between a nurse and a doctor. If I have a medical emergency, I'd far rather have a nurse at my side than any doctor.
Because they're going to have some knowledge, because they're going to ask the person, you know, some questions or something, and then they're more than likely, you know, a lot of these things are, like you said, Amy, people are touching the floor. Many times people are really in a crisis at the time. And the only thing we do is we're killing people by calling 911.
Yeah.
We're putting
it is dangerous, especially if you are not present. If you're calling from afar, you have a concern about somebody you're worried about elsewhere, and you don't know what's going on, and people do that all the time. And
you're breaking up a little bit.
I think I'm going to drop off and listen for a little bit. I'm having a lot of technical problems tonight, so I'm going to drop off and listen, so thank you.
I think that these are really important issues to be raising and getting people educated about, and then creating some alternatives for people of ways that they can mediate their situation that doesn't require relying on the traditional system.
I'm hoping that this doesn't come to pass, but you know, this is a very, very dangerous thing that's coming about. You know, to have it so that states, I'm just surprised that a Republican representative has even put this forth, because this is really taking things away from the state. It's making states, you know, that don't have assisted outpatient treatment. And I hope that, Amy, that you can come back on and comment on this, because, you know, I'm just surprised that a Republican and that Ann Coulter and these people, I just don't understand how they could be involved in this and overturn what. There's a handful of states that don't have assisted outpatient treatment of any kind, but to elevate it to the federal level and to force these states that some of them have very innovative outreach programs that help people, and to put this in this fascist, you know, 1930s Germany style operation in the press. I don't understand how they were fooled.
Well, I think this is a good point about the Republicans not, you know, usually that the call is less money, less involvement of the state. But the problem is that they don't see us as humans, and they see us as animals that need to be controlled.
But they're not actually,
you know,
calling for more money. They're talking about taking money away. They think that some of the preventative programs that SAMHSA had, and I wouldn't hardly call SAMHSA anti-psychiatry. I mean,
no.
And some of these things. I mean, we've had, how many children have we had that died from suicide because they were bullied to the point where they took their life? I mean, I mean, it's just like your data on the number of shootings. If we add those up, that's going to be more than these killings. It's just like they're just, you know, reacting this way. And then on top of that, I didn't even mention that Murphy wants to take to make the psychiatric hospitals eligible for Medicaid dollars, and we all know how, well, maybe they don't, and the listeners don't know how expensive. It could be $200,000 to maybe $280,000 per year to keep a person in a psychiatric hospital.
To keep each person. Not to keep
each
the facility,
person.
But each person.
Yes, per person. You're right. I stand corrected. Per person. Per person, and that would be taking monies away from community services, and I think that that's going to affect even more in rural communities. I saw on the Murphy's opening statement, he mentioned Senator Deeds from, State Senator Deeds from Virginia, and he said, now that I think that the story came out finally that it wasn't a matter of bids not being available. They just hadn't called around to an, but he's, this was the case, in case people don't know it, a state senator in Virginia had taken his son in for, try to get his son committed in the hospital, and they told him there was no beds. And he went home, and the son attacked him, and he killed himself. And there's only two people that know what really happened there. That's the son who's dead and the state senator. But this is one of the reasons that they claim that they're pushing for to take this money. So it's not new money. It's just money taken from community programs, and so that you will have all of this in the hospital now. At a very expensive rate. I don't know, at $200,000 to $280,000, I could have around the clock nursing staff in a 3 or 4 star hotel.
Right. And so when you really think about where is all this money being spent and who is it being spent on, it becomes more like a jobs program and something that fuels the industry instead of really helping people, because locking somebody up in a building where they can be drugged and restrained and secluded and just ignored and just held there is certainly not helping that person. And so the idea psychiatry has something to offer is what they're pushing, but there's no evidence of that. And if anything, there's centuries of work that has been done to try to eliminate these places. So a bill in 2014 that's trying to reinstitute the use of institutionalization will not only take us back to the 1930s, but it'll take us back to the 1850s. And if I recall correctly, that was a bad place to be at the time.
Well, they claim that that's not what they want to do, but I can't see anything but it. I mean, I have not been all that a favor of stigma campaigns, but you know, for I can remember the last 10 or 15 years, some people have all constantly talked about stigma. Well, if you have a environment in which people can be put into forcibly treated if they have disagreements. I mean, we've made a lot of talk in the last few years about shared decision making. You know, what? No one is explaining. What happens if you say you don't mind having some intervention, but if there's a particular intervention you don't want? Maybe you don't want that drug that makes you grow breasts. Maybe you, there are some people that find that the chemicals, despite, you know, all the other information, is helpful to them. Suppose you decide you just don't want a particular one. Does that mean that they can force you to take a medication that you want? A friend of mine was talking to me. She lives in Virginia, and she wants to take the medication, but because of her insurance, she cannot get the medication that that she thinks she should have. So what happens if she decides that you know, she just doesn't want to take the other medication and she picks and chooses? Does that mean that she's going to be forced?
Yeah, I think unfortunately that under this law, it's that you don't have the right to pick and choose anymore. I want to give the number out. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you'd like to call in, area code 267-521-0167. And we do have another caller on the line from area code 613. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi. You're on there.
Hi, Eric. You're on the air? Yep.
Yes, name is Stephen Wittenberg.
Stephen?
Hi, Stephen.
You hear me?
Speak up, yes.
Yes, I'm Sue Clark Wittenberg's husband.
Hi, Stephen.
Yes. Pardon?
Hi. Glad to have you.
What would you like to talk about?
Stephen, what would you like to talk about?
Well, when I was a child, I was put on Ritalin just because I was bored in school. Which is, I'm against drugging the children.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's wrong. It's wrong to drug the children.
It is wrong.
The doctor wanted to send me. Hello?
Continue.
Yeah, the doctor wanted somebody to see a psychiatrist, and we said no. I went to see the doctor one time, and the doctor, he said, come back and I'll give you a diagnosis. I never went back again. Didn't want any of the crazy diagnosis from them. The diagnoses they're crazy. I don't believe in all that garbage that they give you. These psychiatric diagnoses, they're not worth anything. I had doctors ask me questions that, stupid questions. If you say something, they want to give you some medicine. This is crazy. And then Sue, she has a hard time with her memory. She has a bad memory. The whole thing is psychiatry is a bunch of big fraud, I call it.
It is a fraud, and what they're doing to adults is one thing, but what they're doing to the children is something entirely different. And I think Dan had also mentioned earlier about the resveratrol trials and other ways that they're drugging these kids who. You know, why aren't they giving them more time to play or making education a more satisfying experience or smaller classes or nutrition or any of the other things that can be done to help young people try to figure out their way in this world? They're not doing any of that. They're just mass drugging. All of these children and the press is not
talking about this. I mean, some things it seems to me defies common sense. If you tell me that you don't feel as though you should have medicinal marijuana or recreational marijuana available to people under 25 years of age because it's going to affect them. I mean, these other chemicals. I mean, and been a man-made in a lab, don't they affect you? And what happens when you're talking about people that are 2, 3, 4? I mean, and people will say, nah, Yvonne,
they don't give people medications that are two or three. But we know people that they've given they've given these chemicals. I like prefer to use the word chemical. They give these chemicals to very young people. And
The antipsychotics, there are some of them that are prescribable for 0 to 3 years old. Haldol is prescribable to a three-year-old under 3 years old. How do you give one of the most potent, damaging poisons, Haldol, to a child to 0 to 3? How do you even adequately... I mean, first of all, the diagnosis of schizophrenia is fraudulent in terms of science because it's based on observation, not based on any actual medical testing. But how do you observe a 0 to 3 year old child for schizophrenia and then decide that this is what is necessary and put them on Haldol?
Well, you keep repeating over and over again the same propaganda phrases incessantly, such as mental illness, anosognosia, and medication. You say, well, the child was diagnosed at 2.5 as having bipolar, so we gave her medications. We gave her Seroquel and Zyprexa and Depakote. Rebecca Riley was dead at 4, but they give toddlers or young children these drugs, and they just target as many as they possibly can.
And then they give the psychiatrists immunity and charge the parents with murder. So
the psychiatrist is having a good old time while they're still in jail. But, you know, there may be people listening to this that may not be as informed as we are, but just thinking about Haldol and what it can do, prolonged use of Haldol does for an adult. So people can imagine that on a 2 or 3 year old, even a 5 year old. There are kids in school that are taking Haldol, Zyprexa, and these antipsychotics.
Ritalin and Risperdal. Haldol and Ritalin and Seroquel are all in the same class of drugs. They block dopamine transmission in the brain, and they're neurotoxic. So to say, well, we've detected early schizophrenia or bipolar in a young child, and then to give them neurotoxic drugs is outrageous. But they've sold as much Risperdal and these other drugs as they possibly could, and they've been targeting as many different classes of people as they could, including children in foster care and children in schools and infants, everyone they possibly can prescribe their patented, trademarked products to increase sales, they've gone after. They have no concern about the welfare of pregnant women or elderly people or babies or teens or anyone.
Yes, it's rapidly, some of these medications are rapidly being given to senior citizens as well.
Risperdal is causing stroke in the elderly. Stroke. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine a young person taking, just think that when people take Haldol over a prolonged period of time, they develop tardive kinesia, so they have Parkinson-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm. That's also true of the new improved ones, the so-called atypicals, Risperdal and Seroquel. They can cause tardive dyskinesia, enough brain damage so that you're sticking your tongue in and out and facial grimacing and so forth, and because it's damaged the movement areas of your brain.
Yeah, that go away, doesn't it, after you stop using it? Doesn't go away.
It could. Not that they intend for anyone to stop taking the drugs. Then they give them Cogentin, once they have movement problems, they also prescribe Cogentin to try to help with the movement problems.
Mm-hmm. So when you see people that you might see in public transportation, and you're seeing someone who's moving their head from side to side, and they're sticking their tongue out from side to side, that person has been crippled by chemicals. They have been crippled. We used to have, I remember my first visit to St. Elizabeth's Hospital here when they had a larger population back in, 1997. There were people, and they kind of shuffled along, and I thought they were, what would have, and I was told, because I refused it from the very beginning ever to take any antipsychotics, that they called it the Haldol shuffle. Have you ever heard of that?
Absolutely. Once you become like 95 years old or something, your dopamine transmission in your brain is slowly burned itself out, so that you see like a person that's 90 years old, maybe their face is like a mask, and they're moving slowly, and they have a little tremor, and they're slow to do things. Well, these drugs attack the same and block the same transmission. So these drugs are causing people to be like 90-year-olds. That's what they're for. Is they, by blocking the dopamine system, which is brain reward, they can block any unwanted thought or behavior. And so it blunts any kind of mania or psychosis, because it blunts all thought and behavior. It makes a person apathetic.
Mm-hmm. And Lauren had said this a couple shows ago. These medications were never intended, to be used for long-term use, that the studies that brought them on the market were only for, 6 or 8 weeks or something like that. But
yeah,
yet you have
how
people
long
on
trial.
I'm sorry?
How long the trials are to prove that they're safe and effective. Yeah, like 6 week trial to prove that they're, and then they put them on people on them for maintenance forever. Because without using any medical tests, using an interview and the judgment of the clinician, they say, they put you in a descriptive category and say, like, you're one of those. You're one of those people, and so you need to have your symptoms and yourself controlled by our drugs forever. And so they've made a killing in the market.
And we still don't have a test for it. Sometimes we have aha moments on this show because some people still aren't of the belief. Some people are of the belief that this is, these are chemical imbalances and biological illnesses. So we asked a person who called in, who I admire greatly, but I asked them about this, and I talked about the evidence being brain scans. And I'm doing this now. I'm asking people, how often does your psychiatrist or your doctor give you a brain scan? And inevitably, people are saying, well, they either never had one, or either they had one a long time ago or something. And I say, well, if the brain scan is evidence of an illness, it would seem as though that they would want to do them often, you know?
Right, but we should also, I get the point that you're making, but I also want to just interject here for anybody who may be listening to understand that there is no actual brain scan that can detect any of this. There is no blood test. There is no genetic findings. It's all positioned in... Someday we may find some evidence for something. And in the same sentence that they say that, they act as if they have that evidence already and that what they're providing is going to be helpful and good and should be supported by the society and by tax dollars and that it's okay that we take away people's civil liberties because this is good for them. And what is going to be the line as to who gets to be determined as to being able to have their civil liberties taken away from them? When is the line drawn? And with this expansion, or this loss, rather, of privacy rights, of wanting to relax the HIPAA standards to allow family members to be involved with the process of involuntarily committing adults, this is going
to be... It looks like this. Where will it end? So, you know, maybe your employer should be able to, you know, where will it end? A family member? Why would a family member who you don't live with, why should they talk to your doctor? Why wouldn't they say that your employer would be able to give or get information? Someone that you spend 8 hours a day with. You know, this is a slippery slope.
I think that people also don't realize the mass amount of people that are actually involved with psychiatry. So within the state-sponsored system in New York, for example, there are about 170,000 people receiving mental health services each week, about 170,000 people. So they want to, you know, Tori and Jaffe and Murphy, they all want to haul out these, you know, individuals who commit mass crimes and murders as representative of an entire group of people. There are literally tens of thousands of us, hundreds of thousands of us across the United States who are being impacted by this based on the actions of a very few people comparatively. And when
they're making money off of it. It's a lot of money. Lots of money.
It is a lot of money, but when this happens with other groups, if they were immediately going, like, people who were, you know, that all of the work has been done to try to end discrimination against people who are Muslim because of terrorist attacks. It's the same kind of thing, that a small group of people go out and do something, and now everybody who is part of that group is somehow suspect of this terrible behavior. And that is the epitome of discrimination. That is the epitome of profiling. And so one of the things that we really need to start educating people about is how discriminatory this is. That the idea of holding up people like Elliot Rogers or any of these other folks as if they are representative of people with psychiatric histories. Elliot Roger and Adam Lanza didn't even have psychiatric labels. They were not labeled, quote-unquote, mentally ill. They were, however, labeled with other things, which is as devastating to the developmental disabilities community and the cross disabilities as it is to people with psychiatric histories. But they are hauling these people out as if these are like the poster children of what it means to have a, quote-unquote, psychiatric history. And they are not. And I'm not sure exactly how to get that across. And with Tori's newfound best friend in Ann Coulter, I thought you want to talk about an unholy alliance. I'd like to know how that happened. But, you know, where they're absolutely with disdain and disgust using words like schizophrenic and ticking time bombs and madmen that just need to be locked up, this is the message that the society is getting. And we need alternative views to show people all of the other side. And
I don't know what's happening to our press. What's happening to our press? Because I don't know if this kind of I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a low blow when you have someone like Ann Coulter. I mean, it harkens back to a time maybe last year or so ago when. A young lady was called a slut, asking for reproductive health for women. And I don't know what is wrong with the press, the mainstream press. They, when they have these people on, they're not asking the critical questions. I mean, we brought up things on several shows, and just even the thing about the brain scan. These are just common sense things that if you just, you know, just ask a person to explain to me. I mean, it's like, you know, they get someone to sit in front of them and they say they have a couple of degrees, and it's all of a sudden, do they give them some medication beforehand, or, you know, what's the deal? I mean, I know that some of these people are experts. I even looked at that guy that testified today, that it's all a business, and people should be paying attention to the fact that you have many of these people that are making these testimonies. They have a very extreme economic gain to be made. You know, if you're the major source that forensic panels come to ask a question to, of course, you have a vested interest in testifying. If you're the major testing lab, that there's one major testing lab that the FDA uses, you know, you have. If you are on a foundation which gives over half the money for research on bipolar and schizophrenia, you know, I mean, you have some kind of, you're not an impartial person. You're greedy and you want to make more money. And I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe when some famous person is taken advantage of, or a billionaire or whatever else, maybe, I hope we don't have to wait that long, because a lot of people could be hurt in the meantime, and a lot of people have already been hurt.
And it is really hurting.
Yes. The ticking time bombs, the idea here is that if only they had been caught and detected as people that needed treatment and been given medication, then everything would be okay. And now they want to treat people that are not a danger to themselves or others. So what they're doing is trying to make a world where everyone can be screened by an official, can label people non-medically by interviewing them and giving them word tests and interrogating them and getting their behavioral reports and reports by their relatives, and put that all together and make their professional opinion to put a person in a descriptive category, and then that becomes the diagnosis. That's the diagnosis for the person, and then you can give them the medication, which is a brain drug, which patented, and if only everyone in the country can be selected by officials, then we can prevent crimes from happening by making sure everyone is treated according to what the official says. So we're talking about
prevent the crimes from happening. You can't convince them. I want to use the time, and I'll let you finish to tell people if they're upset about this, they should call their U.S. House of Representatives, their congressperson from their district. I would recommend that people, if they can write a letter to their U.S. congressman and explain to them that they urge them not to support this bill because of the effects that it would have. And if you cannot write a handwritten letter, maybe use the internet or telephone. Even if you, most congresspeople do have a district office in their district as well as one on the U.S. House of Representatives, so that you can have a loud voice to say that this cannot happen. And also ask your family members and friends to do the same.
Absolutely, and we have another caller in from area code 212. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Seth, Dr. Farber, Dr. Seth Farber.
Hey, Seth,
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, Neil. Sorry, I missed the show because I've been studying, looking over some stuff for the panel we're doing tomorrow on how the left has ignored the crimes committed against so-called mental patients, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years, et cetera. I don't know what you were talking about in the last 5 minutes. I mean, just before I dialed in. But
yeah,
you and I are going
panelist,
to be doing this thing at the Left Forum, which I don't know if you mentioned it yet today, on Saturday. And the Left Forum, usually 4,000 people come. Sometimes people pay $30 for the day, and sometimes they pay $40 for the weekend or something like that. And I think we're the only panel on you, me, and Dr. K and Lynn are the only people speaking against psychiatry. Last year there was Icarus Project, but not this year. Am I correct? I looked through it and I didn't see anything else.
I didn't see very much myself, but yes, I have been talking about it every now and then on air. Seth Barber and I and several other people are going to be presenting a panel, The Anti-Psychiatry's Challenge to the Left. Saz Lang and the MAD Movement. And so that will be Saturday, May 31st, from about 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock. Is that right, Seth?
Yeah, about 10 after 3 to 10 to 5.
And Left Forum is going to be held at John Jay College of the City University of New York. And I believe that walk-ins are welcome and that people can register on the spot and attend.
But, it seems that obviously over the past few years, over the past couple of decades since I got involved, the system has gotten worse and more harmful. And they're passing bills. The legislators are now well, this is not new, but they use the state in order to increase the profits of the pharmaceutical of the drug companies.
Right.
They have an immediate effect. Seems to be something that like with Murphy's Law and things like that. They say it's working. The problem is the reason it's working in the short run is that it comes with services and resources that people can't get anymore and any other way, particularly housing. I mean, I know one woman, and I know to several, but I know one, right, who is, you know, the only way she can get the housing is so expensive in New York, the only way she can find an affordable apartment is to go through the mental health system. Mm-hmm. And now she's not on drugs, but she lives in fear that they're going to come and you know, AOT her. Now she doesn't meet the criteria for AOT, but I think it's getting looser and looser. Is it not? Do you know, Lynn?
That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be danger to yourself or others. That used to be at least part of it. The unfortunate thing about that is danger to yourself or others was usually that was decided by the psychologist or the psychiatrist. who have no ability to predict danger. Numerous studies have shown they have no ability to predict danger to themselves or others. And it has not been on the basis of any past violence to self or others either.
But now what you're saying about her getting housing, there are innovative programs like Pathways and Housing First programs that, you know, give people housing. Because, you know, if you're homeless and you don't have a place to live, I mean, it's very difficult. And a lot of people, their circumstances just improve just by the fact they've got a safe place to live. ALT by itself, assisted outpatient treatment, is not a service. It's a judicial process. And what they're proposing does not come with additional monies for community. Actually, they want to take monies away from community programs via Medicaid and put them and give them to psychiatric hospitals because they believe that we have another 50,000 to 70,000 bed shortage. We don't.
Bed
shortage. That this is what the those proponents of changing the mental health care system, which we know is not that good, but this is what they want to do. They want to play a shell game so that they can put money there. But your friend may have been in one of those innovative programs, and if these states have AOT programs and use the Black Robotech, I'm quite sure they may have other things put in. Like I said, it's not the federal government alone that's looking at the states. These TAC and these other organizations have been very active. Very well, your friend might, as she said, she has a very good reason to fear, and she should be listening to us and getting involved to help, because someone might say to her that you may have to be actively involved in treatment, and treatment by some people means only chemical intervention. We know that's not the case, she has a real good reason to worry, and everyone
she
else
is.
She
is looking for a psychiatrist who she can, but she doesn't want to take the drugs. I think that's what people have to do. The drugs, particularly the antipsychotic drugs, we know, you know, and I know, on the long run, are destroy the body and the soul. They do. They make people quote unquote sicker. They make people more psychotic, as Bob Whitaker has been saying for a number of years now, and his the various different studies have shown that people are more likely to get better, quote-unquote, recover. I don't like to use this medical language. That's why I keep saying quote-unquote, but people understand that. I could put it another way. But so they get better, more likely to get better without the drugs. So they're being forced to take something that's going to make them sicker in the long run. So what she has to do, and I guess other people has to do, is try to find a psychiatrist, or else go to a psychiatrist who they're able to lie to. I mean, just take go there, fill out the prescription if you get a prescription, and flush the drugs down the toilet. I mean, wouldn't you say that's a probably a way to do it without subjecting yourself to harm?
Well, there's some psychiatrists.
What?
There's some psychiatrists that are getting away from drugs.
Yeah. I can't. What?
Jim?
So be having people come around to talk to you, like, and see if you're taking your meds and say a couple words to you and go on, right? So assisted outpatient can be a community program where people go around, and people can be court-ordered to get electroshocks, be transferred to a hospital, or court-ordered to take the drugs. And if they think you're not taking the drugs in their assisted outpatient program, then you could either be taken back to a mental institution or be ordered to take depot long-lasting shots.
And they can do this to people who have not committed any act of violence against anyone, right?
Yeah, they can do
this,
but I want to say the AOT is not a program. So even if they order you to take it, as I was said earlier about a friend of mine, if they order you to take some medication, it may not be available to you. So they can order, a judge will, it will be in the orders. Even if we didn't have AOT here for a long time. If your doctor orders you to take some medication in a support order, and even if it's causing some harmful effect and the doctor wants to change it, he has got to get the judge to change the court order.
He has to
He has to get the judge to change the court order. They have it actually written down specifically what drug, what day treatment program. I'm not saying you would do all those things, but that's what can be in the court order. And there might not be services there because you
usually
have
to
do all
the drug will, the drugging will be usually billable. That's the whole idea. They want to be able to
they make
bill
money,
for the drug. So that's usually Medicaid or state.
Are you saying that they can't bill anything else, and that's one of the
I'm not saying that. I'm saying if they press large amounts of people,
and
have another wave of people that will be processed judicially, the mental health systems are not getting extra money. So you will be pressing people in a system to get services that may not be there for
them. They are getting extra money. They are getting extra money. There are millions of dollars being infused into supporting the court orders. And
New
York,
the court order,
to pay for the drugs.
For the people to come and you know, barrel down your house. And as Seth was saying, for having committed no act of violence, for having committed no crime, and for having people who...
You might be a ticking time bomb.
What?
You could be a ticking time bomb, though. So that's another selling point.
The fact is that the drugs make more people. I mean, it's a myth that not taking the psychiatric drugs is one of the great myths, makes people violent, blah, blah, blah. There are many things that make people violent.
Oh, it's
but
the exact opposite. It's the withdrawal that can make you violent.
Right.
Antidepressants can make people violent.
True. Antidepressants can make people violent.
Obviously, Peter Bregan has testified over and over again that almost all of the school shooters were on SSRIs, which are antidepressants. And David Healy has written a book on it. A large percentage of violence is committed by people. Zoloft, Prozac, they don't make everybody violent, but they make some people violent. They make a lot of people, not a small percentage, but that's a lot of people, because you look at the people. If you look at the people who are doing strange things like killing the wife that they loved and have no history of violence in their past, they're likely to be on Prozac or Zoloft.
Mm-hmm.
So
their brain has been affected and they just are operating totally other than they would normally, and
that's a phenomenological. You're giving a phenomenological description of how the person on Zoloft who commits an act of violence feels, right? Am I correct?
And I have never heard of
the drug make people function wrong, and people commit crimes that they wouldn't normally commit without a thought of consequences, like they've been brain damaged or something.
The other myth that's been going on for a long time is that you said there's an element of truth in it, that if they don't take their their antipsychotic drug, they will become violent. Well, it is true that that if they get off that drug abruptly without being you see, the psychiatrist should be helping them get off the drug, because as Bob Whitaker has shown now, and you know, he's brought these studies to the attention of the public, as he's shown the long-term effects of staying on these of neuroleptic drugs, so-called antipsychotic drugs, for 5 or 6 years, and Grace Jackson and Peter Brake have shown this over and over again. One thing Bob shows is that they don't get better. They are less likely to get better. And in terms of what people consider better, they're less likely to have a job, less likely to be working. I mean, in terms of full recovery, in the Harrell study, the people who were not taking drugs, there was something like 40% got better, full recovery, and 5% of the people who were on the drugs had a full recovery. So it's the opposite of what people think. So whatever happens in the short run is a kind of optical illusion, because it's a result of people saying, gee, this drug is awful, and just throwing it out and getting off it abruptly and having a terrible reaction to that. But psychiatrists are not doing their job, because they will not take people off these drugs. They will not take people off the drugs that cause tardive dyskinesia. I remember in the 90s, when I was reading when the APA came out with a study on tardive dyskinesia, and they admitted that something like 65% of the people who had been on the antipsychotic drugs who had been on it for like 20 years were going to get tardive dyskinesia, which is a terrible, terrible thing. They admit that it's an awful, it's like Parkinson's disease, for people who are listening and don't know what it's like. The symptoms, the feelings, are like Parkinson's disease, and sometimes people think, the observer thinks, it's mental illness, but it's a result of the drugs. Now, in the APA report in 1993 or 4, they admitted it. You know, 10 years ago, they didn't admit it caused tardive dyskinesia. They admitted it, but they said, well, this is something that the mentally ill have to take, because schizophrenia is such a terrible disease that it's better that they take drugs and get tardive dyskinesia than that they suffer from schizophrenia. Whereas now we know that if they get off all drugs, they're much more likely to recover altogether.
Exactly.
Right. And so I think that anybody who would like to hear more about what Dr. Seth Farber is doing, Seth, do you want to give out your website or contact info?
Yeah, you can call me at our website, Seth, 212-560-7288, 212-560-7288, or www.sethhfarber.com. If anyone's interested in my book on mad pride, I have a book on the mad pride movement, which is a Langian book. I don't know if anyone here is old enough to remember R.D. Lang, but my book is in the spirit of R.D. Lang, and saying that the people who are, when I was in the movement, supporting the movement in the early 90s, almost everyone was schizophrenic. We had been labeled schizophrenic. Now it's different, because people get labeled in as children, blah, blah, blah.
We just have a minute left before we're going to get cut off, so I'll make sure to put the link up online there.
What do you want me to say?
Lauren, is he coming back on?
What do you want me to say?
I hope you'll come back on another night and talk more deeply about the work that you've done.
Oh, yeah, sure. Next week is...
And Daniel, also, Dan, thanks so much for calling in. And Yvonne, as always, I really appreciate you being there. And
no problem.
We have some upcoming events.
I think a lot of people I know from Facebook that are on here.
Yep.
If you'd like to leave
a tip for me, something you'd like to see covered, 718-273-8708, area code 718-273-8708. Thanks for talking. Talk to you soon.